Thanks for coming. I'm Scott Dowd with arts-louisville.com. And of course, you know Maestro George Mester.
How do you do? Thank you.
And we're so glad to see you here tonight on this beautiful evening for the Boston concert, the penultimate concert in this season. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the relationships between these pieces. Although it is the Boston concert, they're all French. And we'll talk a little bit about how this was put together. And I'm interested because you were talking the other day about the connectivity of these pieces and some of the things that were going through your mind as you were selecting them.
Nothing was going through my mind as I was selecting them, except I did a lot of research. The reason it's Boston is because Boston did either the world premiere or the U.S. premiere of some of these pieces. The Revel, I believe, was the world premiere. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. The Poulenc may have been also, but the Poulenc is not on the program, so I don't have to worry about it. And the reason it's not in the program is because when things became obviously parlous about our future, I think the U of L chorus was not able to wait around and see whether we were alive or not, and so they very wisely withdrew. So instead, we programmed the Bizet Arlésienne number 2, which was not written by Bizet. It was compiled and orchestrated and put together by a composer by the name of Ernest Guiraud. And Ernest Guiraud is famous these days because he was the man who wrote the recitatives for Bizet's Carmen, because originally Bizet's Carmen was an opera comique in which you talk and you sing. But they decided to go with this written recitative in which the orchestra accompanies the singers. And also he wrote the recitatives for, what is it?
Offenbach.
Tales of Hoffman. Now, what's fun about this guy, Ernest Guiraud, is that he was born in New Orleans. And he was one of those child geniuses and was sent to Paris to study and became friendly with Bizet and so on. Now, we've recorded a piece by Guiraud back in the days when I was here the first time around. And it was, there was the New York Times critic, Schoenberg, had been plugging for a long time a romantic renaissance. And we participated in that. We actually went up to Indiana to a festival of romantic music, and we recorded a whole bunch of romantic pieces, including the one by Guiraud. It was called something, I don't remember exactly, but it was called The Fantastic Chase or some such thing. And he was a very great influence on Ravel. So all these connections are pretty interesting. Then there's also the connection that Bizet and Ravel use in both of the pieces that we're playing tonight, some kind of folk or folk-like material, so that there is that kind of connection. Now, to be frank, I never thought of these things when I put the program together. One of the reasons I programmed the Ravel is because it requires a virtuoso oboist. And I don't know whether you know, but Marion Gibson, our principal oboe, is retiring at the end of the season. And so this is a great way to show her off. What more? There was one piece that I've left out.
I was going to mention one of the interesting little sidebars about this. The piece that we're going to hear from Mio tonight, the Songs of Ronsard.
Which we also recorded, you see? Yes, with my then wife. There you are. Just something extra. Things nobody knows anymore.
But you mentioned Poulenc. Well, Poulenc and Ravel and Debussy all set these same poems to music. They all wrote music for these poems. So there's just another piece of connectivity.
Right. It was just amazing that I was so brilliant without knowing it. Then is La Mer, of course, and that is one of the supreme pieces ever written. And what's supreme about it, among many things, is the fact that it actually makes you feel that you're near the sea, you can smell the salt and the spray, without actually doing Walt Disney type of Mickey Mousing. You know, so that some magical thing, he's able to evoke the spirit of the sea without painting boats and stuff like that. Also, I don't know how many of you know about the Fibonacci principle. But the Fibonacci principle is a mathematical
construct.
Construct, thank you very much. that sounds silly when you describe it, which is, it is every number is the equals the sum of the previous two numbers. So that's pretty interesting, except for the fact that that is what underpins the growth of seashells, trees, and flowers. Mm-hmm. And it's also what is behind the golden mean in art. Now, Bartok used it, and there's also another French composer whose name I can't remember now, used that principle to build some of the music. I'm not sure that Debussy knew anything about it, but for some reason he was able to use that to build this piece. So somewhere along the line, I didn't know I was making a great program, and he didn't know he was doing a Fibonacci piece. So that's what we have in common.
It's instinctive. It's instinctual with Debussy, which is kind of what he's known for, as being an instinctual composer. And he understood the principle without being able to put a name to it or knowing its number, which is 1.16003388.
What's that?
And goes right on. That's the golden mean. That's the first part of the golden mean,
pretty mean
formula.
Yeah.
Anyway, he knew that instinctually. He uses a lot of musical onomatopoeia too in this piece. And I was going to talk to you and ask you to talk a little bit about, it was really revolutionary at the time when he composed this, for it not to refer to anything mythological, human,
right,
material at all.
Right. So, and there's some places that that I think somewhere along the line, I read an analysis by somebody brilliant who, there's one moment when there's the voice of the deep, you know, and you have this incredible brass thing that sounds like, Neptune rising out, but without naturally wanting to depict Neptune. Anyway, it's a great piece, and it ends rather abruptly. I've never used it as an ending piece in a concert because I was worried about the ending, which is brilliant, fast and loud, which is always good. You have to remember when you program, be sure it's fast and loud. the audience was caught by surprise when we did it yesterday and then gave it a standing ovation, which lasted longer than most standing ovations. And once I remember we went to London, Kentucky, my first time around. It must have been around 1969 or 1970, and we did the Miraculous Mandarin piece by Béla Bartók, which is really, really scary. And they gave it a standing ovation for about 8 seconds and left. So I guess they had to stand in order to leave.
Well, this is a conversation. We don't want to just talk at you. So do you have any questions about the pieces, about the music? Anything you'd like to ask Maestro Mester about tonight's
concert? You can call me George.
George.
Thank you.
Okay.
Anything? Nothing? So you know everything. Yes.
I'm
Oh, yes, Boston was either not the Bizet, because the Bizet is taking the place of the Poulenc Gloria, which all of these pieces were either commissioned or premiered in one way or another, either world premiere or U.S. premiere in Boston. That's the thing. Yes. Thank you. Oh, good. All right.
So another
fabulous
connection.
Now, I can tell you a little bit about some of the movements, because since you don't have program notes, by the way, we haven't talked about program notes. Have you noticed, to your chagrin and dismay, that there are no program notes? It was a fiscal decision, because we had the choice of either having program notes or meeting our payroll. So I will be your program noter. Now, the first movement of the Debussy is From Dawn to Midday on the Sea. The second one is Play of the Waves, and the third one is The Dialogues of the Wind and the Sea. Not very well received when it was first performed. Two reasons. One of them, the rehearsal had not gone very well. And also, French society was shocked, I say, because he left his wife for a singer. I know how he feels. So, anyway, so that was that. But soon it became obvious that he had written a masterpiece, and society couldn't stop that. I do have some of the titles. Pastoral, this is the Bizet, the suite. Pastoral doesn't need intermezzo, minuet, and farandole. Farandole is a community dance, it says in WikiLeaks. Wikipedia.
Wikipedia.
This is not a secret. That was very popular in Nice. And it required community, which I guess it must have been like a square dance kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Ravel, this is an orchestration by Ravel of a piece he wrote for piano. It's the Tombeau de Couperin. Tombeau doesn't mean tomb in this particular case. It's a 17th century word that means homage. And so each of the movements of this piano suite that he wrote was an homage of a friend of his that had died in the First World War. And so I have the names here, but they don't mean anything to us other than spiritually. He then took four of the movements and orchestrated them. And of course, he orchestrated almost everything that he wrote for the piano. So the thing is that it's not even an homage to Couperin. It's an homage to French keyboard music. And so that's how it came to pass that he did that. And the movements are Prelude, Forlan, and that is an Italian folk dance from the Friuli Venice. And sometimes it was called Friulan and Forlan. And so that's that kind of dance from the Friuli Venice area. The third movement is Minuet, and the fourth is Rigaudon, which is a French folk dance from Provence. Okay, so now you know even more.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about the Mio. I had hoped that we would have a chance to introduce you to the soloist for tonight's concert, but she's getting ready, so she'll sing a beautiful concert.
One of the reasons that I told her that she need not show up is that there's this word in singing called tessitura, which is the area where the voice is actually placed during a particular piece. And so this is for coloratura soprano. It was written for Lily Pons and premiered at the Waldorf Astoria. I don't know how they did it, but it was Andre Costellanes, who was her husband, conducted the first performance. So it requires a little bird to sing these four songs. And if she has to speak to you, then her tessitura is really low, and then to change from low to high is really a drag. So she is working on the altitude of her voice at this time.
Yeah. But I want to talk a little bit about her, and maybe you can tell us just a little bit about her background, because in addition to the concert work that she's doing, she does a lot of opera.
Right.
And has a pretty spectacular range and control of her
and
voice.
Also, she's a born show person. I mean, when she comes out on stage, everybody goes, wow, this is really great. So she has this way of addressing the audience that is really very, very seductive and exciting and entertaining. So she's going to talk before each of the songs, or no, before she starts singing, she's going to tell us a little bit about the songs. And I believe that you have the poetry there, which I would urge you to read. I think we're also keeping the lights a little higher than usual for the songs so that you can read if you want to follow along. The French is, of course, kind of archaic. It sounds a lot in many places like Spanish. So for me, even though I speak French, it's easy for me to understand this poetry because a lot of it sounds or looks or reads like Spanish.
It was written around 1552, so that's the reason it
not
reads
the, not
that
the
way.
Piece, the poetry.
The poetry. The poetry was written around 1552, which is why it reads so archaically.
You know, there's still some members of the orchestra that played in the recording when we did it in the 70s. It's pretty amazing. Yeah, but nobody recognized it when we started playing it. And you know, we recorded so much music. Very often, I have not heard a lot of the records that I made. I would be shocked if somebody were to play, for example, a Walter Piston symphony for me. I'm sure I would not recognize it after having recorded it in the early 70s. Orchestral musicians are the same way. I'll ask them, you know, how was the concert two months ago that somebody sang in or played? Can't remember. So once you played it, it's like, you know, that's it. Let's go on to the next one. Very interesting.
Does everybody know about the recordings, the first edition recordings? Because at one point, the Louisville Orchestra was the first, and for a long time, the only American orchestra to have its own recording label, and did quite a collection of recordings of music from contemporary composers
at
the time.
The amazing part was that I think in the 50s, the Rockefeller Foundation gave Louisville a $1 million matching grant. And that's how it came to pass that the orchestra, then having all this money, my predecessor, Robert Whitney, and Mayor Farnsley got together to find out how to upgrade the status of the city, because the city was then known for fast horses, booze, tobacco, and fast other things. So the plan was to commission composers from all over the world to write music for the orchestra, then it would be performed and then recorded. So originally, there were 12 records a year put out by Rob Whitney, which is unbelievable. You know, it was an incredible job because he had to learn all of this stuff, which very often the ink was not yet dry. And so once I arrived on the scene, that it was also self-supporting. All those records were sold all over the world to subscribers and also to USIA libraries and university libraries. So that paid for the recording thing. Then we started getting more and more useless is the word, because eventually in the 80s, people started recording also. And now you have Nonesuch and all of those record things, which are recording everything that was ever written. And so it was exciting. So what happened when I arrived, the money had run out for commissioning composers. So my job was in a way difficult in a different sense, because I had to find music that had never been recorded, because it was called First Edition Records. And what shocked a lot of people was that when Schoenberg, the critic from the New York Times, started pushing the idea of a romantic festival. I loved it because there was a whole bunch of incredibly important music that had never been recorded. And so I started putting out those records, and of course some of the subscribers went nuts because they wanted to hear the latest contemporary music. Anyway, I survived that.
If you get a chance to listen to any of those recordings, I mean, they really are amazing and yeah, historically important, and they're still available. And
many of them. They've been put out by several different companies. There's been always a kind of uncertainty as to who owns the rights to them and all of that, and I believe the U of L has a...
They have some of them, and yeah, some of the, quite a few of them are on compact disc now. So if you don't have a turntable, you can still enjoy
including
a number of
the,
them.
The songs Ronsard, they're available on a CD. Okay, well, I believe my time is in.
Yes, we're come to the end of another session, and thank you all for being here, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the finale concert, and then we'll look forward even more to seeing you in the fall for the 2011-2012 season.
Let us pray. Thank you.